commission and
Two on the phone.
I hope I can find it because I would like to look at it.
Good afternoon. I call to order the 69th meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingard. I live in Delaware Township in Hunterdon County.
Jack Shire, Morris County Freeholder.
Elizabeth Calabrese, Bergen County Freeholder.
Bill Cogger, Mayor of Chester Township.
Mimi Letts, Persephone, Morris County.
And Kurt Olsbitt, Chester Township Public Member.
Tracy Carluccio, Public Representative, Hunterdon County.
And on the telephone we have
Debbie Pascarelli, Greenwich Township, Warren County.
Janice Kovacs, Town of Clinton, Hunterdon County.
We have a quorum present. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have in our packets the minutes from our last meeting way back on May 15th.
I'll move the minutes of May 15th.
Second. Okay, second. Any comments or corrections? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay. Minutes carry. I have no items to report. Other council members have items to report this time? Okay, and we'll turn to the...
I just wanted to report that the DEP back in March determined that the turtle could not go under the road. Just wanted to do
that. That's right.
The pipes were too high for the turtles.
Okay.
You recollect, Mr. Chairman?
Oh, yeah, I do. I was thinking about chickens crossing the road, but I'll move along. The executive director's report.
The long week since I last saw you, we've had some meetings. We've been meeting with these county planners, meeting this morning with Hampton Borough. And other than that, we've been working on master plan issues, so I'll wait till that point.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'm having trouble hearing Eileen today.
She hasn't said too much yet, but okay, we'll try to talk up. Committee reports, the TDR committee met. Scott Whitenack admirably chaired that committee meeting, but it's not able to be here today. And there is a detailed report of that committee meeting, which he is reviewing, and we should all get a copy of it soon. There were a number of council members there, and also Charlie Seaman was there offering his national perspective advice on transfer development rights issues, and John Stokes from the Pinelands Commission. Monique Purcell from the Department of Agriculture and a number of members of the public as well, and I think you can all look at the report we get. And my sense is that the staff has come a long way in making what has to be a complicated process clearer and administratively simpler, or administratively less complicated, I guess is a better way to put it. And there are some issues related to that will come before the full council. The committee essentially approved what the staff has presented to them, and that will come before the full council at one of our meetings in June.
Mr. Wayne?
Yes.
I'd just like to commend Jeff Cava and anyone else on the staff who helped him put the TDR technique for assigning credits together. You know, they did a terrific job with it, a very difficult challenge. And Jeff, I finally understand it all, I think. I got those algorithms down pat, so he did a good job.
Thanks. comments or questions on that. We do have two local grant applications to consider this afternoon.
Yes, both of these grants are for mini assessment grants for plan conformance. One is from the Borough of Hampton and the other from the Borough of Hopatcong. Just to sort of give you background on both of these, so Hopatcong was awarded a $7,500 COLA grant on October 6th of 2005. They've received payment on that grant, delivered the deliverables on it, and that grant is now closed. Hampton Borough was awarded a $12,500 COA grant April 20th, 2006. They have not provided an administratively complete letter from COA at this point because they have a court issue with their COA compliance, and thus that grant is still open. Those are the only grants awarded to Hopatcong and Hampton. So the grant before you today for both of these municipalities is in an amount not to exceed $15,000 for the purposes of studying the implications of the regional master plan to both those communities that have land in both planning and preservation areas while they consider plan conformance.
So this is $15,000 each, not to exceed $15,000 each?
Each, correct.
So it's two contracts?
That's correct.
Okay. Resolution wording is a little unclear about that.
The resolution covers both.
Right, no, but it says enter into a grant agreement. So it's enter into grant agreements, basically, for initial assessment grants.
We will change that.
Okay. Would someone like to move that?
Move that as amended.
Sorry.
Any comments, discussions?
I would just add that I think it would be a little clearer if after 15,000 it says each, because I too was confused about that.
That's okay, but then we're in second direction.
Yes. Okay.
And these are both towns that are split between the planning area and the preservation areas. No other comments from council members? Are there any comments from members of the public? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Thank you. Okay, we now turn to item 10 on the agenda, regional master plan discussion.
Okay. We have a PowerPoint to guide you through this and to guide the discussion to the public as well. The first issue we're going to discuss today in terms of the master plan are Highlands, Open Waters, and Riparian Areas, Goals, Policies, and Objectives. We are going to continue the 300-foot buffer requirement for all Highlands, Open Waters, in both preservation and planning areas. This was the same as was in the 2007 final draft. What we did want to do was to have some consistency with other areas and with the Act itself. And in terms of that, it's the need to address disturbed buffer use and restoration in the planning area. The final draft regional master plan did not address instances where there are existing disturbances within the 300-foot buffers in the planning area. We wanted to make this consistent with what the Act spoke to for the preservation area. Public access to some urban streams may be appropriate in disturbed areas. Require a measurable and scientific approach to ensure no net loss of stream buffer functional value. And the RMP should include scientifically defensible policies on where and how disturbed buffers can be used and or restored. So we used the Highlands Open Water definition from the Act for clarification and consistency. We had done a study and a breakdown and analysis of the conditions of streams within the Highlands area. We will continue to use that. I'll speak about it in a few minutes. But we wanted to simplify the language here, so we just took the language from the Act. The policies were revised for the planning area. Proposed disturbances shall only occur in previously disturbed areas, and the following sequence of low-impact best management practices be employed if any disturbance is allowed. And this is consistent with the approach we've taken elsewhere in the regional master plan. If possible, to avoid the disturbance of Highlands open water buffers, and when that is not possible, to minimize impacts to Highlands open water buffers and mitigate all adverse modification to open waters, so the buffers, so there was no net loss of the functional value of the buffer. Clarify that key functional values of buffer include, but are not limited to, and there are four main ones: habitat, water quality, temperature moderation, and channel integrity. The mitigation requirement of no net loss of functional value ensures improvements to one or more function and no net loss of any function in the mitigation design. A new objective was added that encourages opportunities to restore and enhance Highland open water buffers in all zones, in both preservation and planning areas, and example restoration techniques have been provided. And policies are clarified that through plan conformance, municipalities will develop and implement a municipal-wide or sub-watershed-wide stream corridor protection restoration plan that will make use of watershed and riparian area integrity scores from the technical report January 2007. And those are the scores that I spoke to earlier. We're still going to use that analysis. It was very valuable, provides a baseline for us in working with municipalities on stream corridor restoration and protection plans. Protect the functional values we spoke of a few moments ago broadly, not just site-specific. It's better to look at the entire sub-watershed, or at least within the municipality, at opportunities to protect those functional values. Identify remedial or mitigation opportunities in these plans. Provide for a systematic procedure for evaluating specific stream reaches in the sub-watershed, and prioritize locations for rehabilitation. So these are the changes that we propose based on comments received for Highland open waters and riparian areas.
And when do we anticipate this being done by the municipality?
During the plan conformance process, we've set forth that this is going to be a long process, but there's some things that are required for plan conformance with conditions to get that conditional plan conformance, others that won't. That will take more time.
A question. Where we say that existing structures or improvements within Highlands open water buffer areas in the planning area, that they can't do anything unless they the town approves it, or we approve it, right, or the Highlands Council approves it. So if somebody has a home that's within one of these areas, are we saying that they can't put a deck on it without having to get an approval?
No, the and we'll get to this later on in the meeting, is that the exemptions from the Act or the waivers from the Act will be applicable to any project in the planning area as well. And so you can apply for an exemption. For example, activities under an exemption will be authorized, or a waiver.
This would mean they're going to have to come and get an exemption or a waiver just to put a deck on their house?
That's part of the conformance requirements we're going to discuss for exemptions and waivers. Are a process by which either we'll be issuing certain ones and or delegating the authority for the local approval for those activities, so that once we get a town to conform, that they can actually be issuing it in accordance with their building permits or subdivision site plan approvals. So things that will go through the local level, they can analyze those issues, and if it's not subject to their plan, that can be
addressed. Well, who would approve it? The building inspector?
Probably
the construction department, or they have to go before the Board of Adjustments?
No, it's be the zoning official who would rule. You wouldn't advise them, but the construction. Zoning would determine that you're either accepted or not.
So now they've got to go to construction, and they've got to go to zoning board.
The zoning official have to sign off on it, so that would be where it would be determined.
And the way we see this playing out is this: as towns begin to conform, the council can, where the council is comfortable, delegate that authority down to the local level.
This is a concern that the towns that have a lot of homes on waterways, on lakes, have about this particular facet of the plan.
Well, activities that are exempt from the Act, to undertake those activities, you don't need to come to the council unless the municipality requires you to.
That's actually, as I said, we'll get to this later, but one of the tricky parts is not all the exemptions are alike. Some of the exemptions actually require a detailed analysis and finding that you actually do comply. And DEP is doing this now. DEP has specified that certain exemptions they don't need to see. And so they've taken a subset of the 17, five of them, and said, we don't really need to see these. Similarly, what we're recommending is the council would take a similar approach, specify which exemptions we would need to see or the locals would need to see, and specify which ones we do not need to see. It can be delegated at a local level.
And will we kind of give some guidance and say if this is a nominal change, a deck or something that we suggest that...
We're not going to discuss this today. I mean, this is on the agenda today.
Yes, it's at the end.
It's the plan performance standards?
Yes.
Well, land owner equity.
Land owner
equity. Yeah, what we did was we wanted one place where we dealt with all exemptions and waivers, and that's under land owner equity. It's new. It's before you today. Okay. So we will get to it then. But we want to, basically, meaning for things like you're talking about, for additions, they still have to conform to local regulations as well. So we'll be going to their zoning officer anyway to make sure that their setbacks and things of that nature were still adhered to. So those kind of things are similar.
So the zoning office can just make a determination, and we'll make sure that through conformance we set the standards.
Yes.
Where he can do that without having to go to the Board of Adjustment or...
Correct. We're not going to make this more onerous than it need to be.
Please.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So I have a lot.
Wait, are you going to go to what Mimi was bringing up or to...
I think... Unfortunately, there's some overlap.
Okay, no, I understand that.
I'm trying to be particular to this, but if it overlaps, it's not intentional. So there's a lot that is adjacent to Highland Open Waters. Okay, so say it's a 3-acre lot. It conformed to the local zoning at the time of the implementation of the Highlands Act. Same ownership still, so there's an exemption to allow that person to construct a single-family residential home. Now, does that mean that that person then doesn't have to deal with key functional values?
Yeah, I mean, exempt activities are exactly that. They are exempt. So if a single family dwelling, just to play this out, and the Act has a limitation for the exemption number two in terms of the activities which are allowed underneath that exemption. You can build a single family dwelling. You have to disturb no more than 1 acre, and you can't add more than 1/4 acre. As long as you stay within those thresholds, that activity under that exemption is exempt not only from DEP's rules, but from our plan and any local conforming ordinance requirements.
That applies only to the preservation area.
No, we're going to get to that later.
Yesterday you told me that one was only the preservation area.
That particular exemption applies to both the planning area and the preservation area.
So there's no septic lot density...
For lots that were in existence,
lots that are existing, right?
we have to remember it has to meet the statutory
definition. Just run it through these scenarios.
So that says you because I brought this up yesterday. If the exemption says that you can go to 125% of the original footprint, shouldn't this be consistent with that exemption?
And that's what Eileen was alluding to before, is that we're putting one provision in the plan which deals with all exemptions and all waivers, so we don't have to repeat it in each and every resource section of the plan.
I know, I read that. That's why I was questioning this.
And that's true throughout the plan, is that if you're exempt, you're exempt from the entire plan. We're not going to repeat each and every exemption throughout our plan.
Got to make clear which exemptions apply to the planning, preservation, or both.
And we will get to that. And what, when we wrote this up, we called out exemptions 3 and 17 are the two that apply only in the preservation area. But that is called out in the later program. Otherwise, the rest of them will apply within the planning area. So that's why you got the answer you got, Kurt, even in the planning area.
So
those exemptions are the exceptions.
You can either put this as a footnote or address it now, but under landowner equity then, objectives 7F1H, it says that while the construction activities of a single family dwelling may be authorized under an exemption, water conservation requirements, septic maintenance requirements, or any other activities related to the use of the dwelling are not exempt.
That is correct.
So what you just said to me, that everything's exempt, but it really is not exempt.
No, but I'd prefer to discuss that later.
All right, well, it's doesn't matter, because it connects.
Yes, it does.
So can we pick that up at Can we do it live on record?
Chairman's prerogative.
Yeah,
let's
maybe we should do that one. Yes.
Well, let's do this one while it's up here on the specific changes to open waters as I think described them. Any comments or questions?
Give me an example of when these key functional values kick in. A project or somebody wants to build some sort of structure in a 300-foot buffer, and they seek an exemption, and there's, I guess, sufficient evidence to warrant granting of approval for this construction, but then they have to abide by the mitigation requirements or the no net loss of functional value. Is that the way this all intersects?
Putting exemptions aside, this is for projects that are not exempt.
Right. So I come in, I got that lot, but I decide that it would be more appropriate to build a retail store there.
Exactly.
And I'm able to, I have a compelling argument, council agrees, so I receive the exemption to build this retail store, but then it's contingent upon no net loss of the functional values.
Again, put exemption aside. If you're exempt, you're not subject to this. This is for a non-exempt project. You wanted to, your example is perfect. You have an exemption to build a single-family dwelling, but you want to build a commercial retail store instead. You're not exempt, so you'd be subject to these provisions in the buffer areas.
So the only way you could get approval then to do such a thing is if you could demonstrate that you could do it without any net loss of the functional values.
Yes, but that's only if you expand the footprint, right? Because what it says is structures and other land improvements.
Doesn't say that, Tracy.
On objective 1D4D, it says structures and other land improvements existing in the buffer on August 10th, 2004 may remain. And then if you want to expand that into the 300-foot buffer, then you have to do the functional value analysis, according to this. Am I understanding it?
Yes.
For planning area, right?
Correct. And this is where I said the language was made consistent with that for the preservation area from the Act. Because the Act spoke to structures within the 300-foot buffer in the preservation area, so we use the same language for the planning area.
It says that you can expand it to within 125% of the footprint. That's what I had asked yesterday. Why isn't this consistent?
Again, that's an exemption issue. Anytime anyone's authorized under an exemption and they're approved under that exemption, these provisions would not apply. These are only for non-exempt projects.
So if I'm going to destroy some habitat, then I need to restore some water quality in an equal amount. But somebody has to tell me how much habitat equals how much water quality.
No, because it's each of the four functional values, no net loss of any of each of the four.
You can't replace one with the other. So,
no.
So if I ruin habitat here, I got to replace it over there. And it has to be done within the lot. It can't be done, or can you mitigate outside of the lot?
Well, this is where we get into the stream restoration plans as well. Dan, do you want to respond to that?
Or not.
Or maybe not.
You get to a certain level where you have to get into the actual project review standards, and that's the sort of thing where if you look at DEP's rules, for instance, the preference is to do it on the lot. If you can't do it in the lot, you do it within subwatershed. You know, and we're trying to use the stream corridor restoration protection plans or the protection restoration plans as a way of essentially pre-planning. Where can you do the mitigation? Where can you identify buffers that have already been damaged and brought back so that you have that sort of option of either doing it within the property or within the same stream reach so that it benefits the same stream? Those are the kinds of things that you're looking for. You would not want it to be done in some other sub-watershed where it has no relationship to the stream buffer that's being damaged.
But will we be able to give waivers against that provision? I mean, if somebody just can't find any place to put this stuff,
they need to apply for a waiver.
Exactly, and that's the, we provided a similar waiver relief that's available for the preservation area and the planning area. So, that similarly, if you're not exempt, you could seek a waiver of the resource protection standards in the plan.
Okay.
But the waivers are for narrow grounds.
Yes,
they are
very narrow.
Yes. That's under objective 1D4.
But what if you don't meet this?
Do it, then you can do it.
That's right.
Can I just ask you? I understand that there can be no loss of these criteria. What about things like historical value and things? Are you going to have people that are living in historic dwellings, demolishing them and expanding them out and being compliant then with the plan? I mean, that's part of what we're supposed to be protecting too. So do we say that that's okay? You can take down that grist mill and build a McMansion as long as it's only 125% of what existed prior to that because you owned it?
No, we don't say that, but we don't get into historic structures here. We actually are going to get into historic structures under ag, but those are for historic ag structures.
But in Bill's example, that could be exempt from the ag.
Absolutely.
And so the only way it would come into play for us would be in terms of setting priorities on land acquisition or other.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Or if the building is recognized manner as historically protected.
It's just an issue that we're going to face with all of this infill that's going on in the areas.
Right.
So, and since we're charged with that, we've got to cover it somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Are there any more slides on this section, or is that?
No, this is it.
I just had a couple questions, sure. Clarifying questions. Under Objective 1D2A, you talk about the Highlands riparian area shall consist of flood-prone areas, wetlands, soils that are hydric. That's not, since it's not tied to the 100-year floodplain, which I think is good, then will on-site tests be done in order to identify the hydric and the alluvial soils? I mean, we don't have all that mapped, right? We do have it mapped?
We do have it mapped.
Okay, good. So then this would not require testing for each and every...
These areas have been mapped, and the maps are available online.
Okay.
We do these when we're doing the WQMP amendments. We've been looking at these, and that's where we see these coming up as
okay.
well.
But will somebody be able to go in online at a block and lot number and find out whether they have alluvial or hydric soil?
Okay, you're jumping into our next phase of the HIMAP, which we did talk to you about, and that will be available for anybody to look at, public and municipalities, to pull up any of the layers so that they can see this kind of information on our website.
So if I'm approved,
I'm sorry, can you go, Chris?
Well, I have other questions.
Just go back to these functional values for a minute, looking at the hierarchy of the functional values. So if someone were to receive approval to construct something on a farm field, and it was going to take an acre of that farm field away, then they would have to create an acre of a farm field someplace else. Under habitat, no net loss of in-stream food sources, and no net loss of terrestrial and aquatic habitat functional value due to shift to a less valuable overall vegetative condition in the protective buffer based on the following continuum from highest to lowest. So presumably, if this construction were to occur in a field that's within the buffer, I could replace that. I have to replace that field with either a field or something. Ag field or something of higher value, which would be pasture or meadow, scrub, shrub, forest, or wetland. So I could take a lawn and turn it into an ag field, and that would be good because then I'm making a higher value and it's equal to what was lost.
Yeah, so these are going to be done on a site-by-site basis to make sure that there is no net loss of each of the functional values.
Has anybody ever done this before? Is it?
It is being done by DEP. Now, we're not married exactly to do it the same way, but we've taken the four major functional values, and then we'll do a site analysis with the Highlands Council.
And they're doing it with what, stormwater regs?
Or? Yes.
The water quality, I think the functional value analysis is going to make this work better. Glad we fleshed it out. Under number two, water quality of pollutant loads, are we defining it the same way DEP does, just TSS, or are we looking at other pollutants?
We're not to that point yet. The idea is to focus on the critical pollutants for stream function. TSS is an indicator. Mm-hmm. It's not the only pollutant of interest. So we may want to take a look at probably not a huge number because that makes the whole system very difficult to deal with, but I wouldn't mind looking at a small number of critical pollutants.
I was thinking that, say there's a TMDL for the stream, it would be good to look at those pollutants. Or if it's an area where we know there's high background nitrates, it would be good to look at those areas. That we, it should be done on a site-specific basis rather than just the indicator does. I agree with that. As far as under the next section there, which is objective 1D4, we're talking about developing the plan, during the plan of conformance to the stream corridor plan. I mean, I can see where that would be very useful in identifying, for instance, water quality problems that then you would need to, you could plug into your functional value assessment and other things. I'm wondering under number two, providing...
Which subletter?
Two or
what?
4I.
It's 1D4I. I, sorry. I'm working off the one I downloaded. It's not as clear. Yeah. 1D4I. Talk about the plans. And then number two, it says provide for a systematic procedure for alternative highlands open waters buffers based on an evaluation. What does that mean? Alternative.
Go on, Don.
Just to, as an example, one of the functions that buffers provide are water quality functions. The 300-foot buffer is an approximation of what often is critical for a stream with regard to water quality. But if you have a topography that actually part of that 300 feet leads away from the stream, then that part of the buffer is not, in fact, critical for water quality with regard to the stream. On the other hand, you could have a situation where, because of the topography and the movement of water, there's somewhat more than 300 feet that is critical to the water quality of the stream. And this is called variable source area technique. It's a technique that's been used in the Midwest and is now being used here in New Jersey. So that kind of scientific analysis can be used to define what actually is critical with regard to water quality for the stream, as opposed to using a fixed buffer distance. Likewise, can be done with regard to habitat and so on. So that's what it means. But the key is to have it based on science. We didn't want to get into a situation where there was an arbitrary just changing around a buffer. That's not what you do. So that's what we're getting.
Well, my concern is it makes it sound as if now we're weakening or making very vague the 300-foot buffer. We're still going to stick to the 300-foot buffer.
The 300-foot buffer is the standard in the plan. The critical issue is that 300-foot buffer is set for specific purposes. And the question is there another buffer that actually gets you a better result? That's the critical issue.
But I guess I just want to express my concern that this is very vague, and I'm concerned about alternative highlands open water buffers, meaning that we will be negotiating the buffer on each stream depending on whatever. And I think there's a lot of science to argue about whether or not the 300-foot buffer provides something more or less than the 300-foot, than water quality. And there might be other aspects of that buffer that are just as important that we wouldn't want to compromise having to do with our goals of the plan.
It would have to be for all four functional values, at least, because that's a minimum number. Those are not the only ones that are necessarily going to be used.
But you're talking about the plans here, not the functional value analysis.
Yeah, which shall protect buffer functional values that are no less protective than the requirements of 1D4D through 1D4G. That's the critical statement there. It cannot, and it has to deal with all of the functional values, not just any one. I raised one as an example, but it has to deal with all of the functional values.
Okay, well, I still have concerns about these words, alternative, because it makes it sound like we're now, it's open, where it's not necessarily going to be 300, 150, it's going to change. But if that's what you're saying, then it should say 1D4H, not G, because objective 1D4H includes the functional value analysis, and that's excluded specifically.
Certainly can do that.
From number two.
Not a problem. And we'll look at the language again just to make sure that it's really super good. Secretary for the NPH.
Tracy, do you have other?
Yes. No, sorry, that was it.
Does anyone on the phone have comments on this section?
I do, John.
Okay.
This is Debbie. Can you hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. I had to switch phones. I was having trouble hearing you. I just want to make sure it's not the line. To follow up, Tracy had a point about weakening of this one specific area, which I couldn't find on my materials. If actually somebody could give me that number again between the different versions I have here, I have to locate it. What specific policy or objective was that?
It's objective 1D4I section 2, or subsection 2.
Okay, 1D is in Debbie?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's what I couldn't hear, D or B is in boy. I'll look it up in a minute, but when I reviewed the materials for the meeting today, I see a lot of the same problems that have been identified a number of times in the past at these meetings when we're reviewing these policies. And it's a lack of specification to the point of ambiguity, and a lack of standards, a lack of clarity on situations that exist. And I chose to take this one objective, and that is 1D is in Debbie, 4 E is in Edward. And I took a stab of rewriting it in a way to try and demonstrate what I'm talking about. And I'll share this with you by email later, but I think I can just highlight the points to try and bring it to the attention of the staff, and more importantly, the council. When you read this, there is no prohibition. Well, first of all, actually, I have a question. How does one define proposed disturbance? How does one decide previously disturbed? What's the definition for that?
Isn't in natural vegetation. It's being actively.
I'm sorry, Dan. Could you speak up just a bit, please?
I'm sorry. It is not in natural vegetation. It's being actively used as a land use for some purpose other than natural resource functions.
Does it include agricultural land?
Agriculture. Active agriculture is absolutely a disturbance of an existing buffer.
Okay. Then. I don't think that was what we had in mind when we established the 300-foot buffer. I think we were looking to grant exceptions for redevelopment or in recognition of existing structures. So that's even something I didn't really include but in my wording because I wasn't sure what that was. But if we're going to, and this is another one of the really core issues related to the fundamental intent of the Act, is protection of the waters. And, you know, if we pay closest attention to any parks, this is one of the ones we should be doing it with. This, in using that one objective, of course, a lot of these are related. There needs to be a statement made that says, within the protection conservation zones, in that cleaning area we're talking about all the time, development activities are prohibited. That has to be what the policy is. And then exceptions specified very clearly, not using words like avoid, minimize, mitigate, but say things like, the only waivers of this standard are going to be under the following conditions, which is first and foremost redevelopment, and to specify things like it'll be limited to the footprint of the previous development, no waivers if there's a reduction of existing vegetation, no waivers to less than 150 feet, no matter what. And then your points, you know, well done on the demonstration of no net loss of those functional values. I mean, that I think you have in there somewhere else. But the result of this kind of a language is there's a couple implications. First, I don't know as a municipality how I would implement some of these things based on what I'm seeing. I wouldn't really know what it means. I know we haven't seen some ordinances yet, but, you know, we're providing the guidelines for their development, so I'm going to assume that the model ordinances are going to be similar to this. And wherever, and the second thing is that there is an exception to every rule, and an exception leads to it coming before the council in some sort of whisper process. So are we looking to, I mean, if we have a developer come in and they request a waiver, the township committee would be the local planning board would be required to refer it to the council. Is that what we want to be doing? I mean, and frankly, I don't see municipalities conforming under those circumstances. It'd be a tremendous loss of home rule. Where it's not like, so if you have very, very specific conditions under which a waiver be required, and very specific requirements for that, yes, the municipality could look at this and say, yeah, well, you know, I feel comfortable. And only in circumstances where, you specify the circumstances under which a waiver would even be considered. There's none of that in this. And my last point is, and wherever there's ambiguity in land use rules, there's litigation. And, you know, those of us who have written local ordinances and master plans, we're very, very aware of that. And we are very specific. So, you know, I'm sorry I sound like a broken record, but quite frankly, I don't see any changes in the nature of the materials that come to us. It's the same problems over and over again. And I hate for whoever's sitting on this council 3 years from now to be looking back and saying, wow, we didn't really, you know, consider it from this point of view and what the implications of this language is going to be. So I'm going to ask the council again to think about this carefully before we proceed with adoption of a plan that's fraught with this kind of language. And you've heard these same things from the public a number of times. So I know I'm not the only one that's concerned looking at this.
Mr. Chair, I do hope that when we get to the end of this meeting, when we take you through an example of plan conformance standards as they would be applied to steep slopes, you will see the level of detail to which we are going with this. But then remembering this is a master plan, and there are many details throughout this in the goals, policies, and objectives. But on one side, we're, you know, what I'm hearing from the council at times is too much detail, and at other times is not enough. But I do hope that when you get to that last point today, you'll see an example of the level of detail which we will get to with each of these, followed by a model ordinance.
Good. Are we going to have a definition of previously disturbed areas in here? And the reason I bring that up
is we can definitely do that. And it is taken directly from the Act, but we'll give a definition.
But you know, you've got issues where, you know, what's abandonment? I mean, you've got all of those issues that you have to deal with that there's lots of case law about. So if we use something other than what's been there for pre-existing, even though they're not conforming uses, and throw it out, Debbie's right, we'll wind up with litigation.
So we'll, Tom will work on a definition for us.
Am I correct in saying that agricultural development is exempt from this buffer requirement?
Actually, we're going to get to that in the agricultural section coming up. So,
I think, Kirk, we did work with Monique Purcell from Department of Ag on this as well. And so what we did was we put some language into the agricultural resources, again, to try and keep things in one place that apply across the board. But it wouldn't apply just here. It would apply for other resources as well. So when we get to agricultural resources, if you flag it, I do recall, though, I did put it on the slide.
Maybe somehow that should be incorporated here. My concern is that, you know, like the answer of the question about this section is in another section, and how are people going to know that?
Well, this was another difficulty we had from the council telling us that the document gets longer and longer.
I know.
And you asked us to cross-reference. We were going to do a matrix for that, but we were keeping, that's why we have the exemptions and waivers in one place now. We have the agricultural, and that's why we would have repeated the agricultural language in each of the resource areas. We thought it best, following council's direction, to put it in one place, and that would hold true for all ag resources. Exemptions and waivers in one place that holds true for exemptions throughout the document and waivers throughout the document. Otherwise, each of those areas is going to be repeated under every single resource.
Yeah.
And where are they now for our review?
The exemptions and waivers are under landowner equity that was sent out to you. The agricultural goals, policies, and objectives has a language as pertaining to agricultural resources use and development.
Can you just give a simple answer?
So
we don't lose track.
Exemptions and waivers are all under the landowner equity section. Anything pertaining
except for ag, but then ag is.
Anything to do with ag is under agriculture.
So just so that we're working on these buffers to entertain me. You can continue to farm a field inside a buffer.
Yes.
Right. If you need to build a barn inside a buffer, it's not you want to build a barn inside the buffer. It's not considered major highlands development.
Right, and there's two things going on here. Is that we continue to have to differentiate between the preservation area and the planning area. So the preservation area allows that agricultural activities in the preservation area, both for agricultural uses like tilling the land and agricultural development like building a barn, are not subject to the DEP rules of the preservation area. They're subject to the 3% and 9% agricultural impervious as per the Department of Agriculture's regulations. So in terms of the planning area, the activities we specified in the agricultural section, which we're going to get to later on, would be consistent with the Right to Farm Act, done through agricultural best management practices, and in where necessary for public health and safety, done through the Right to Farm Act.
So your answer is yes, as long as you comply with those regs.
Correct.
In a buffer.
So, because there's no exemption for agricultural activities from the Act.
It's in the definition of major highlands development.
Exactly. And right. That's only
because ag is not major highlands development, the rules don't apply to ag, right? It's sort of a reverse exemption.
Exactly.
And so so in Kurt's example, if you want to build a barn in the buffer, does the Highlands Act change the process you go through if the Highlands Act is
yes, there? Because you may trigger the 3% or 9%. Depending on the individual circumstance, and you may be subject to agricultural best management practices depending on that issue.
But you don't have the issues here, though, in terms of key functional values and things that other types of development would require.
Correct.
Right, it uses its own separate track.
Yes.
Which is under the next document.
Debbie, did you start to say something?
I just wanted to add, I want to address this to Kurt. Kurt, when I prepared these comments, I wasn't thinking about a barn or an expansion of a farmhouse. I was thinking of some much more, what we would think of as, you know, commercial development, things that aren't related to existing agriculture or suitable, you know, really wasn't related to agriculture. Because I think in some ways those are different issues. And they should be considered differently. And are not specified here in any way. I'll bring up again. That's all.
Mr. Chairman, I want to go back to 1D4I again, just because I think perhaps I'm misunderstanding what you're saying here. Are you saying that a stream corridor protection and restoration plan is to be done by every township during plan conformance? And according to number two, something other than 300-foot buffers can be laid out for those streams, even if there's not a proposed development? Are you talking about only when you've gone through all the hurdles and now you're going to be able to disturb, and this sets up a process for how you're to come up with the width? I don't know if I'm explaining myself clearly. Are you saying that when these plans are done, that townships could come in to the Highlands Council with a plan that does not provide 300-foot buffers or 150-foot minimum buffers, or not follow those guidelines at all, but come up with something they have decided fits those streams in their town, as long as the functional value assessment is done? I hope you're not saying that.
Could you clarify this, please?
The idea is to have a plan that results in a buffer that better protects the stream than a standard buffer for all functional values.
But are there minimums? Because you don't reference. What's referenced here are the objectives that come after we start talking about disturbances. The 300-foot and the 150-foot minimum and all that are earlier in the document, and they're not referenced at all. So are we throwing out the buffer guidance? That's what I want to know, the 300-foot.
In subsection D, I guess this is,
Right.
It ends saying minimization and mitigation opportunities shall be considered only upon a clear and convincing demonstration that the protection buffer cannot be avoided, so forth. Does I fall under that in effect?
Right. That's what I want to know.
Well, the way I is written, where it says objectives 1D4D through 1D4H now, for instance, 1D4E, which talks about the protection and conservation zones, is among those objectives. And that includes a 150-foot minimum buffer, and it includes an emphasis on avoiding first and then minimizing if you can't avoid. So there are a lot of those kinds of issues that all get played into this. What I will say is that we are going to be developing a guidance on how one develops such a plan, what that plan would have to include, how you make the proofs that you're doing what you should be doing. And so all of that is going to be laid out, and we have to bring that back, obviously, to the council so that you folks can see what we're talking about and decide whether or not it's good enough for you. But I guess the answer is that all of those objectives, which includes the protection zone, conservation zone, and existing community zone discussions in E and F, has to be addressed by the plan.
I'm sorry, I don't think you're really answering the question, though, because 1D4B talks about 300-foot, and development is prohibited within a Highlands open water and its adjacent 300-foot buffer in the preservation, and it goes on and describes in the preservation area, then it talks about the planning area. That is not referenced in this section. I want to know, are you saying that a town can come in and make up any buffer requirements for its streams if they put this plan together and show that it meets the functional value analysis? And if that's what is being proposed here, that is a major departure from the policy discussion we've had for the last 2 years, and I very much object to it. Okay, well, I'm trying to get an answer.
I'm trying to answer
you. Okay.
The answer is this was not intended to change the preservation area buffers at all.
What about the
planning
area?
And so we can certainly put that in and make that specific. With regard to the planning areas, the council has told us from day one that it wants a science-based plan. 300 feet is an approximation of science. The question is, if somebody comes in and does a better science-based plan, is that acceptable to the council or not? That's the question before us.
Tracy, can I just remind you, because what we did, and I'd outlined this in the ED report, Chris Ross on staff had worked on a comparison, looking back at what we had done in the 2007 draft, and then what we were seeking to do was to be more protective. And under the 2007 draft, there was an opportunity to go down to 150 feet in low resource value watersheds with low integrity riparian areas down to 150 feet, and then in low resource value watersheds with low integrity riparian, when you were talking about intermediate waters versus exceptional, you could go down to 75 feet. And this is why we felt this was a better approach. It was stronger and more prohibitive than, and more science-based than that, because we also took into consideration now these functional values. We felt it was more protective than what was happening.
But those instances, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, those instances applied when you would reduce the buffer, when you had a development application before you. This makes it sound like a plan can be done for the town and these buffers be set for the town based on a functional value analysis that's done, and you don't have to follow the 300-foot or the 150-foot guidelines.
And this is because there were occasions where we saw the opportunity that maybe in an effort to protect, restore, and enhance, that maybe there were areas where you would look at a broader buffer for necessity and maybe less in other places, but always looking at the functional value and the scientific background to see what you really want to achieve here, and if you could achieve it in a better way, and if that could be proven to you, then the 300-foot buffer isn't the answer, that it's to really look at the functional values and what would better protect the waters.
But I would note, we should include BSA.
Should include what?
Under that part two where it talks about the requirements of objectives 1D4 D, it really should be B. And I think that's an excellent point.
It should be B, yes, because there's no guidelines otherwise.
Well, more to the point, the preservation area standards are set by statute. And C gets at the DEP requirements, and we have absolutely no authority to make and to give anybody the right to have a buffer less than what the DEP requires. So it makes a lot of sense to have both of those incorporated into the plans. So I would absolutely agree with that.
Dave, can I ask you, you gave a brief explanation of how a buffer less than 300 feet might be even better. And something that Eileen just said makes me think that along the total length of a stream corridor or whatever, you might find that there are areas that you want to protect that are greater than 300 feet for certain reasons. It might be habitat or whatever. And then it might be, there might be very little within, you know, another area that you could really reduce it. Is it possible that we could, like, have an average? I mean, does it have to be a totally...
Well, I think the idea here means
that what we're giving people.
I would not go with averaging. Averaging doesn't really work. The ideas would be science based.
Yeah, 300 foot is science based. Meaning what you're getting at is exactly where we were going with this, in the sense that not the averaging, but the fact that if you're looking at the functional values, there may be places where you want to be greater, and maybe places where it's appropriate to be less because of already existing disturbances.
That's what I was getting at.
But I would note that this really, because of the DEP rules, because of the Highlands Act, this will only apply in the planning area to Category 2 waters. Because if you're Category 1, you have 300 feet.
Right.
If you're in the preservation area, you have 300 feet. In the planning area, in the Category 2 waters, DEP's regulations are all less than that. We start at 300 feet. And so the question then is there any variation for that that's based on science, not based on development needs, based on science? And the suggestion here is that it could be, but you have to prove it. So that's the idea. And frankly, I'd be much more comfortable not having this done where a developer is pushing science, but rather where the municipality is working under performance. But
I have a question.
Yes.
You know, we discussed, I can remember we had these discussions quite a while back. And, you know, we were thinking 1,000 foot, 600 foot, 300 foot. That's for those of you who were with us at that time. That's the conversation that I'm going to try and go back to. I think it was the fall of 2006, maybe, when we had those. We were going through all those policy statements. My recollection is that we agreed to 300 with the possibility of it being widened due to the circumstances.
Well, that is
where the first draft was? Can you just, like, you know, very briefly, a history? In other words, I'm trying to get at how much of a shift in policy is this new language compared to what we had deliberated and debated and agreed to in the past?
On page 2 of the ED report, you have that analysis done where I speak to what was in your 2007 draft and what we're proposing now.
Okay, I'll go back and look. Well, is it a policy shift or isn't it? I can go back and look at the details. I missed that somewhere.
To be clear, the changes we're discussing today to the November 2007 draft are not a policy shift. They are making more specific. They may be uncovering policies people want to change, but they're not a shift from what was in the plan in 2007, to my understanding.
We are strengthening, actually, in a couple of areas where we said you could go down to 75 feet or 150 feet. We took that out. So that's a strengthening from where we were. The provision that Debbie was talking about is still under 1D4J, where the Highlands Council may require on a case-by-case basis the expansion of the 300-foot buffer. So that has not been left. That still lives.
No, I agree. That's still there. But John, I disagree if this means that there are no set buffers in the planning area at all. Because
that's
we
what
did
it means.
Decide that we wanted to have what we called a line in the sand set. based on science. And there was a tremendous amount of analysis done by staff. I submitted a paper myself discussing the science behind the 300-foot buffer. And yes, it was decided it could go down to 150 or 75, and this is a strengthening from that because of the functional value analysis. And that's why I prefaced my comments. I think it's good to have this analysis. But this is new, that you could do a stream plan for your town and not have possibly any 300-foot buffers if you're not in the preservation area. And that's not what to my mind, that's not what the council had come to when we put out the 2007 draft.
My understanding is that there is a 300-foot buffer if you're applying for plan conformance and you're in the planning area. Is that what this is applying to?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So there is that minimum.
24 says it clearly. It says up 300 feet from the edge of blah, 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 blah. Then it goes on to further refine it and say there may be some more scientific ways to evaluate them if somebody can prove it. But I think that the bottom line is 300 feet.
Well, I think...
I don't think that's what the language says, maybe.
I don't
that's
either.
The point I that I'm arguing. And it's back to, in the past, we've seen policy statements that have the strong, not but prohibit, but then you read through it and there's a relaxation of every rule in place. And it's giving that power to the council, not even the local municipality, which it probably shouldn't be. But my point is, this is misleading, some of this language. And I'm not saying it's being done intentionally, but it is misleading. And this is a policy shift based on the answer I just heard.
And I just want to add that based on what in response to Mimi, policy 1D4 is not referenced here, though. It's under number 2. It says, which shall protect buffer functional values that are no less protective than the requirements of 1D4D through now H, or B through H. It does not include 1D4, which is the 300-foot buffer.
I lost you.
Number 2, where the last part of number 2, the last part of that sentence, it says, which shall protect buffer functional values that are no less protective than the requirements of 1D4D and through 1D4H. Now we're going to change it B to H, from what I understand. But it does not reference 1D4. So if we intend still to say 300 feet is the line in the sand that we accept as the scientifically based buffer that's protective for water quality, it seems to me we need to rewrite this too. Because it makes it sound, the way this is written to me, that you could have a stream plan that does not have in any place, it does not approach a 300-foot buffer as long as you can prove these other things.
Well,
And I'm opposed to that, and I do think that that is a departure from policy.
With one caveat, an important one, and the if you look at 1D4E, 1D4F, the first thing it says is shall only occur in previously disturbed areas. Mm-hmm. That remains.
Well, I think if that's why I began out asking, did I misunderstand this? I think we need to rewrite this if you are saying that the 300-foot buffer is still the bottom line. And if you want to depart from that because of a disturbance that's being proposed, then you need to do this functional value analysis, and you can then redo it. But that's not how this reads out.
The 300-foot buffer, Tracy, doesn't that prevail through everything under there unless there's mitigating reason?
Not according to what Dan said to explain that.
I think we can agree this isn't clear because we're coming in. Find people to help here a little bit. So I would recommend that staff figure out a way to present, I guess it's specifically subsection 2, of put that in a paragraph by itself of what does that apply to, the providing a systematic procedure for alternatives, how to open border buffers, and as Tracy asked before, what's alternative mean? Bring that back to us so we could consider it. And I mean, we may not all agree on it, but let's all understand it first.
So we'll bring that back to you in a second.
Are we in agreement that we want clarification?
Yes.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, so okay. I think that's a major step, and it's more than just that one section.
Yeah, but Debbie, just to be clear, the point I was trying to make before in response to what you said, there was that discussion about buffers being 600 feet. Whenever that was, but that was not in the final draft plan. And so
no, I was just referring that to refresh everybody's memory of the meeting. we have this big debate. I mean, it was even proposed 1,000 feet, and we said, no, nobody was interested in that. We sort of worked our way down to 300. No, 300 is the number, and I'm just arguing 300, as Tracy put it, should be the line in the sand, deviated from only in very narrowly defined specific circumstances, and that's not what this whole section of the plan is not consistent with that.
Or at least it's not clear. Okay. Besides that section, are there other parts of this island of waters and riparian areas people have questions or comments about? Okay.
1 hour for each one today, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, yeah, right. Okay. So let's go on. Yeah.
The next section is water resource availability. Policies and objectives were consolidated where possible to improve ease of understanding. The order of the GPOs was changed for better transition. The transition goes through the derivation of water availability analysis, then the priorities for use of water availability, project review standards, mitigation standards, and then water use and conservation management plans. The mitigation requirements, we've incorporated now the concepts from the white paper, which was discussed at the May 1st, 2008 council meeting, and the details will then be in the plan performance standards and Highlands project review requirements.
Comments? Questions?
I have a question. This section of the plan I disagree with. I'm not going to argue about that, the basic disagreement. I just have some specific questions on policy 2B4. It states to apply water resources standards in the protection zone and conservation zone that maintain the integrity of aquatic ecosystems and then recognize the regional significance of these resources. And it says consumptive and depleted water uses for non-agricultural uses shall be stringently limited. I think we were trying to condense, and you refer us over to 2B8 and 2B9. Mm-hmm. But if you look at 2B8 and 2B9, I think, and maybe we didn't do enough fleshing out then, but we have that policy, but then we don't have an objective that addresses the integrity of the aquatic ecosystems. All we're talking about here is consumptive and depleted water uses for non-agricultural uses. And then we go on and talk about, under A, and we further discuss that, the various circumstances that impact that, but we don't at all address the integrity of aquatic ecosystems. So just suggest that we think about an objective regarding that.
Okay, so we bring back to you an objective on the aquatic ecosystems.
Right. Is it the consumptive and depletive water uses? I think we left something out in the translation and trying to condense, and it was condensed a little too much, because I think what we said originally under, I think it was 8 or 9, was consumptive and depletive water uses shall be stringently limited for all uses, not just non-agricultural uses. And now it's changed to just non-agricultural. So I think that was probably just a mistake. It was dropped out.
Under 2B?
Yeah, I'm still under 2B4.
2B4.
And it says consumptive and depletive, the second sentence, depletive water uses for non-agricultural uses shall be stringently limited. But if you look back at the objectives that was to summarize, it was not just for non-ag uses, it was all consumptive and depletive water uses were to be stringently limited. Just suggest that I think that was probably simply an error in our zeal to condense, and we should make it clear that all consumptive and depletive water uses shall be stringently limited, not just for non-ag. It makes it sound like agricultural uses.
Well,
Would you like to say that that's okay?
We did say that under 2B. Look it up.
I don't see it.
We said that originally under 2B, 8 or 9. It's referenced, and in the back, we were given the referenced objectives, policies.
You said it was under 2B, 8 before?
Does everyone have that?
No.
Yeah. Was the intention here to pull that agriculture and deal, so that to deal with agriculture in a different section of agricultural uses, and that's why it's not mentioned here?
What happened was when we collapsed protection zone and conservation zone, both of them have the same 5% low flow margin limit for non-agricultural uses. Conservation zone has a 10% limit for agricultural uses. And so I think Tracy's right in that in collapsing this, we lost some of the nuances there. And it may actually be that that sentence is not appropriate in that policy, but rather is appropriate in the objectives that are specific to the non-agricultural uses. And then with regard to agricultural uses,
to have a separate statement. Because I don't think we intended to say consumptive and depleted was okay as long as it's ag.
Right.
Okay. So we'll create the separate, we'll take that sentence out and we'll create a separate objective to address the ag. Under the next one, objective 2B4A, we refer back to 2B9E as one of the objectives that is summarizing into one. And one thing that was lost there, too, is we discussed the term, that result in the preservation of environmental sensitive zones.
2B4A is where you are?
Yeah, 2B4A and 2B9E. If you refer back to the original, it talks about, there's a qualifier in it that refers to the preservation of environmentally sensitive zones. Just suggesting if you can go and look, I think that something got dropped out there too.
I think it actually got moved to a different place, but we'll look for that.
Okay. Just look it up. That'd be great.
Anything else?
Under objective 2B5A, we talk about the highest priority for the use of net water availability within the existing community zone there, through the use of water use and conservation plans. Can we flesh this out a little bit about how we're going to get to that objective in regards to ecological values? Because up above under 2B5, right there, it says ecological values of the region are to be provided for. And then if you look similarly to above, I think it got dropped out. Under that objective, we then don't talk about how we're going to meet the provision of ecological values or maintain ecological values.
Okay. In both cases, I'm just thinking through this. In both cases, with regard to the protection zone, the way that's done is through the reservation of 95% of the low flow margin for ecological uses, and the same with regard to the existing community zone. It's through the reservation of 80% of the low flow margin for base flow. So the objectives are aimed at the use of net water availability, and that's after you've already taken out the water for ecological uses. So it's implicit, and maybe what we can do is simply add an objective that makes that clear.
I hear what you're saying. I think if you would add that objective, that would do it. Mm-hmm. I have another question for anyone else. Under objective 2B9B, we lay out here these various mitigation efforts through the conservation management plan. Just wondering, what if these are not achieved? Can we And we say at the end that mitigation shall be guaranteed through a performance bond. It would be good if we would think about what actions we would take under that bond. I mean, what would we do if all, you know, these things did not result in what they were supposed to result in? And apparently we are trying to cover that base by saying we're going to have a bond. So if we could think about that and flesh it out, I think it would be a lot better than leaving it vague.
What do you mean by that? Because I would assume, I mean, maybe you should say this someplace generically, that if we had to call in a bond, that we would use the money for the purpose that was reneged upon.
To complete the plan, yeah, to get that laid out.
Is that what you mean to say?
Well, yes, but I guess what I'm looking at is, let's say this mitigation plan wasn't successful. And what would we do? Would we do up a new mitigation plan, for instance? Maybe it was more complicated than them just not putting in a recharge basin. Some of these plans, the way we're looking at them, are going to be fairly complex. And we're going to be counting on models run to show that if you recharge this much or you reduce your impervious coverage, you're going to get these results. But let's say it doesn't work. If we can think about what we will actually do in order to better the plan, I think I would have more comfort.
But wouldn't we have approved the plan in the first place? And
yeah,
if
it
we
seemed to me
we think, plan,
yeah,
we'd have a problem.
I would think we'd be approving the plan because we think it's the best thing we know how to do, and if it didn't work, we would use the bond to try to do something better. But I don't know how we could anticipate that in advance.
I'm not even sure that we would require that that bond be implemented in the case of our approval of a plan that didn't work.
Right.
I don't think that's the applicant's fault here or the municipality's fault. I think that would be an error to take advantage of that bond money and use it to correct something that we have approved.
So you're saying the bond is to be used just if there's negligence or
they haven't
something.
It's a performance bond. If the plan is not implemented as we have approved it, then that performance bond would kick in. That's the way performance bonds work.
Yeah.
But there could be a fine line, I mean, determining performance. I mean, you could say that they didn't perform, and that's, and when you set the road, you go out and you don't just measure the amount of asphalt, and the road didn't work, so you have to make improvements.
That would be the municipality's responsibility. If the municipality approved the plan for which the performance bond was provided, and the approved plan did not give you the road that you expected to have, I don't see that you should punish the applicant.
Well, I think that the municipality, let's say in the case of runoff, let's say that the plan was approved and the water was exceeding the capacity of the drains that were put in. I think that you'd be in a pretty good case to get the developer to put in additional drains or to mitigate further, and you could threaten them with a bond. Because you could say the intent was to provide for the stormwater runoff.
I'm not saying that you can't make a case for it. I'm not saying that you couldn't do it. I'm saying that I don't think it's fair.
I agree. But the issue is that you could use it just more than for clinical, if you chose it, if you go after
it. I think what we probably need is somewhere, and not in this section, but a general statement about performance bonds and what the criteria would be for calling them in, or whatever the right phrasing is, and how that money would be used, and that the money would be used to redress the problem that the mitigation plan was intended to address.
How you say that.
Right, well.
Well, I know we can't make it absolutely specific because these are all going to be specific to a project.
Right.
But I think, though, that we've all kind of come to understand that these mitigation efforts, there is no absolute science behind it all yet. And
there's a lot of both technical proofs and science behind a lot of it, but one of the critical questions here is going to be, and it's really before you even get to the performance bond stage, the mitigation plan has to incorporate proofs that you did what you were, not what you were supposed to do, but that you achieved what you were supposed to achieve. That's a critical difference, because if you're to show that you achieved what you were supposed to achieve, then among other things, the mitigation plan has to be written with, if this doesn't work, then we will do this additional. If it does work, well, then we don't have to do the additional. And well, it's only after you get through all of that that you hit a performance bond issue.
Well, I think the achieve word is good. I mean, that was my question. What if you don't achieve it? What action can we take under the bond?
Right.
And I think what we'll do is what the chairman suggested is Tom will write up something to deal with performance bonding and what the expectation would be and give us some extra language.
Did we put in here, I didn't get a chance to read it all, something about maintenance and mitigation efforts? Is there something in here about maintaining?
Some of the information we gave you, we did talk about the fact that when these things are put into place, what we've seen historically is they're not taken away again. So, for example, if you put in low flow toilets, low flow fixtures, it isn't as if the next person removes them.
Well, I'm more concerned about using detention basins that silt up,
right,
and dams, and issues that confront. We need to have, as part of the mitigation effort, some sense of maintainability of the mitigation. If the mitigation works for 6 months, swell, who's going to take the responsibility after
that? So we'll write that up and into this as well.
No, we're loaded with that retention and detention basins that we made developers put in, but we didn't make them maintain them, and then the towns get stuck with them.
Yeah.
We're designed them so they can be easily maintained. I mean, that's okay. The other part of what you...
Other comments on this section? Kurt, I'm mindful you have to leave in 15 minutes, and I know...
But I can come back. Mr. Chairman, I expect to be back at 6:30 since we're running long. So your option, if you want to attack something that might be more interest or delay, we'll return.
Agricultural resources.
Just like MacArthur to the Philippines.
Let's just keep going. I'm not sure whether there'll be substantial comment on the next section. But
can you ask for it without me?
We don't need a quorum. I mean, we do have a quorum without you, I think, assuming Janice is still on the phone.
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Okay, so we don't need you.
well, that was quick.
So let's go to land preservation and stewardship.
Land preservation and stewardship goal policy and objective changes. Most of these changes relate to clarifying language, removing duplicate language, combining and reorganizing GPOs. There's a new policy, 1H2, addresses all the coordinating efforts and technical assistance needs for land preservation and stewardship. Objective 1H2C states the council's support for innovative alternative methods and programs for land preservation and stewardship as discussed at a prior meeting. Now the next one, this is an important one, new policy 1H7. This was 1H11 and provides for the designation of special environmental zone to comply with the Act's mandate, section 12. The mandate from the Act is that a preservation zone element that identifies zones within the preservation area where development shall not occur in order to protect water resources and environmentally sensitive lands, and which shall be permanently preserved through use of a variety of tools, including but not limited to land acquisition and the transfer of development rights. So this was a mandate in the Act, and in the 2007 final draft plan, we had a policy which spoke to dealing with this. But now what we want to show you today was, given that we had done our conservation priority areas, we have also done more recently the confidential list for priority parcels for acquisition, confidential to Green Acres and BSADC. We now felt we were in a position where we could take this to the next level and take on the Act's mandate for the special environmental zone. What we did is we used parcel clusters within the designated conservation priority areas in the preservation area. We chose five indicators that we felt were the most important for protection of water resource and environmentally sensitive lands, and they are the following: forest within forest resource area, riparian corridor condition high, highlands open water protection areas, critical habitat, and the water quality management tier, but we excluded the already developed lake community subzone. in doing that, then the non-preserved lands were evaluated for the percentage of each of those five indicators, and then the percentages were added. So there was a total possible score of 500%. In fact, the highest we found on any one parcel was 302%. So the range was from 0 to 302%. The range was then reviewed for natural breaks, which resulted in including parcels that scored 192% or greater, and that were connected to already preserved lands. The result of this is 360 parcels totaling 19,000 acres. So what we wanted to do today was tell you what the method that we recommend using in order to come to this special environmental zone, which was again a requirement of the Act. And it is only in the preservation area because that is what the Act mandated.
However, the exemptions still prevail.
The exemptions are still there because they are exempt from this Act, the plan, on any plan conformance.
Questions, comments?
I have a question. Go back to policy 1H7, please. When you're identifying and designating a special environmental zone, permanent preservation, a variety of tools, including but not limited to pre-simple acquisition, easement acquisition, PDR programs, and development regulations. Only that last one has no compensation attached to it. So that can be done by FEA. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think this really goes to Mimi's point, is that the legislature, when they created the Highlands Act, created two major avenues for relief. One, exemptions, and the second, the waivers. And one of those including is a takings waiver. So even where development regulations say this is an area where no development shall occur, one can seek a waiver, just like one can seek an exemption. And if you qualify for that finding, then that can be issued. So that's true for all policies in the plan, including this special environmental zone.
But I think Jack pointed, the way the sentence reads is one of the ways these lands could be permanently preserved is through development regulations.
Right. And what all I'm saying is that part of the development regulation process is the waiver provision.
So if I claim that your regulations have taken my land and made it non-developable, without any compensatory mechanism, then it's a taking.
It may amount to that.
I can apply for a waiver.
Yes.
I get it.
But that's not permanently preserving the land.
Correct, and that's what I'm saying. Is Mimi's point was the fact that the Highlands Act created these outlets will, by the nature of the Act, there will be exemptions that are exercised as their right in even this highly environmentally sensitive zone. So that's why, actually, if you look at 7C, under that, is that we have to recognize that these exemptions and waivers are in the Act, and that the state shall put all its effort in to exercising the opportunity to either through fee purchase or through easement purchase obtain those lands.
I understand that. Now, I was about to say Jack's point, but the point we're both trying to make, I think, is what does development regulations add to that sentence? Because what the sentence is saying is identifying examples of ways in which these lands can be permanently preserved.
But if you've taken the land and you get a waiver because the land has been taken, then the waiver excludes the possibility of preserving the land.
Correct.
Right. So you haven't preserved the land. So you're saying
that's inherent in the principles of the Act. Right. There's no way to avoid that.
Right. Okay. No, I understand that.
But it does read.
But the bottom line is that we will be encouraging the development of development regulations to regulate these lands and recognize that in those development regulations, these exemptions and waivers are a part of that process. That's what we're trying to get.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go. College in the other part. I just, in the front where I was reading the land preservation subpart E, there was no mention of historical elements. And I always considered that part of our stewardship responsibility. You mentioned ag and forestry. I think it would be important to point that out. And two, I just make this briefly, objective 1H3A, where we're talking about our confidential inventory of those lands with a 5 and 10 year priority. I stretched my, I can't, confidential does not mean secret. I'm with Kurt on this. And I can't think of a reason why we wouldn't want to let people know what lands were high priority. If you look at the SADC rules, if you look at the Green Acre rules, you have to go out and get appraisals. It doesn't matter whether or not what the land landowner thinks. This is what the deal will be, what you're able to offer there. So I'm just concerned that I don't know what this inventory does for us. It's going to take a lot of staff work to do it. And we may give it to the SADC or the or Green Acres folks who don't preserve, I mean, don't go actively out preserve land. What happens to it?
We've already done this work, and we've done this list, and we've met with, and we talked to the council about it in a meeting. Subsequent to that, then we did meet with Green Acres, with John Flynn, and with Susan Kraft from SADC, along with Monique from the Department of Agriculture. And we did go over the methodology with them and talk about what they would do with these lists in terms of comparing and working with the counties and the municipalities. And so, and they're in complete agreement with the methodology. And
that's not my question. I had nothing to do with the methodology. My question is process. Mm-hmm. There are lots of nonprofits that go out and preserve lands. They're out there buying stuff and trying to preserve it every day. They're an incredible resource in preserving land. Are we going to release the names to them?
No.
We're going to have them preserve other things other than our priorities. Because why?
Because we're following directly and absolutely the mandate of the Act.
Well, the Act does not say secret. It says confidential. So that inherently means that you can share it with somebody.
And they told us who to share it with. SADC.
Well, is it specifically in the Act?
Yes.
It says you can only share it with the SADC?
Specifically, Bill.
I'll rest my case. I think it's a waste of time and effort.
But does it preclude sharing it with others?
I just, it's nuts.
I think
there's two things here. One is that the list, a parcel-based list, which also includes those that were almost exempt and various other facts that we may have, is one issue. The mapping here, the special environmental zone, is something that we have at a regional scale. We're developing at a regional scale, and what's already in the plan is the agricultural priority in terms of conservation priority for both resource lands and agricultural lands. So that mapping done at a regional scale, which doesn't include the person's name and parcel number, it will be accessible by the nonprofit community in terms of looking at lands that are the most appropriate for to spend their efforts, and that's part of the plan. That's already in the 07 draft, those conservation priority areas for both natural resource lands and agricultural lands. So that, we're saying, is the guiding mapping in terms of integrity, ecological integrity and agricultural integrity, where nonprofit dollars should be headed.
Now, are all these lands in the preservation area?
Yes, the special environmental zone is only in the preservation area.
Right. And by definition of the Act, then, those properties are supposed to be valued at their value at the time of the Act.
There was a 5-year provision for the dual appraisal method.
Are there appraisers out there who are going to be able to go back and appraise these, you know, their value prior to March, whatever, 2004?
Yes, so they did this previously when there was a November 98 provision. Earlier in preservation projects for both Barham and Green Acres. So this is something appraisers are very familiar with.
It's not going to be difficult.
No, they've been doing this for years.
My concern is, I'm sorry, are you going?
Yeah, I am.
Every time we get one of these confidential lists and they're made public, it's a mockery. You know, the green-red map was a mockery. This recent COA map is a mockery. And I sure want to do everything possible to maintain the integrity, and that doesn't mean that I don't trust our staff or SADC or Green Acres, but every one of those other staffs felt that they had competent people too, but there just wasn't enough grassroots outreach to make sure they caught these little things, and that continues to be my concern here, that there's a reason we exist as a council, and it's to make sure that all the regions are represented.
Well, this is not confidential. The special environmental zone is not. The Act says identify. It doesn't say
who's in it is confidential.
No, we can give you this, we can map this. It doesn't say confidential. I just wanted, today we were just giving you the method. You want to see it, you can see it. The world can see it. The Act said identify. What I read earlier was exactly. The previous conversation we had in the previous council meeting was, again, the mandate from the Act on the confidentiality of those lists. We're, as a staff, just trying to follow the mandate.
You're saying those lists pretty much fit into this special zone?
This would be a subset of the special zone. I think that would be logical to...
What, that the lists are a subset of the special zone?
The special environmental zone would be a subset of the confidential priority list.
So they're not all in there.
You can't tell you that because you're not allowed to know.
No, we can tell you this, but not
that they're part of the confidential list.
I understand, it's complicated.
You go from the conservation priorities to the confidential list to the special environmental zone. It's drilled down.
Non-controversial comment, if I...
Right.
Public forestry, if you go over in the private ownership under your goal 1J, there's an awful lot of public municipal forested land that's out there, and it is preserved, but that doesn't mean that they're maintained. And that might be some element that we want to look at and provide an assistance to as it relates to the maintenance of those forested areas.
Kind of get to the stewardship?
Yeah, the stewardship, exactly.
Okay. Feel bad that we're about to turn to agriculture as you're leaving.
Well,
we were welcome.
If you'd like to delay this position.
Any other comments on land preservation stewardship? Let's go turn to agriculture.
Agricultural resources. The general changes were agricultural resource GPOs were revised again for clarification and to address comments from the public, New Jersey Department of Agriculture, and New Jersey Farm Bureau. They were revised to be consistent with changes to the cluster program, policies and objectives, and the white paper on conservation plans and best management practices that, again, we had discussed at a previous meeting. Policy 3D2 and 3D3 amended policy, the wording from encourage conservation plans in the planning area when you reach those 3%, 9% triggers to require. There's a new policy, E3E4, and the objectives 3E4A and 3E4B to address agricultural and horticultural use and development. And this is what we were speaking about earlier. This is sort of the generic to guide us through all the resource protections. To address agricultural and horticultural use and development through plan conformance in coordination with the New Jersey Department of Agriculture, State Agricultural Development Committee, and CADBs, and consistent with the Right to Farm Act. This is so that in one place we can address the applicability of resource protection requirements of the Regional Master Plan. So that's the new policy and objectives. And there were new objectives to address, again, what was previously discussed at earlier meetings, that confidential list of preservation priority parcels, agricultural retention and farmland preservation plans, and development regulations that prioritize the preservation of agricultural lands in the agricultural priority areas and limit non-agricultural uses. Regional coordination with all groups involved in preserving agricultural resources and the agricultural industry to maximize agriculture preservation efforts. And finally, Bill, coordination with SHPO, and this was a Department of Agriculture comment to us on historical agricultural structures. So there are new objectives to address
them. You save the court for a floor question.
There you are, sir.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
In policy 3B4, this is not new, but I probably didn't understand it the first time. It says to permit the inclusion of credits for the control of invasion. What do you mean by these credits?
Oh, this is under the Farmland Assessment Act to give them credits for you know how they're assessed, the value is assessed, keep them in farmland assessment. to give them credits for doing these sort of things because of the benefit it derived by the environment for control of invasive species.
And so some kind of credits that are given out by who?
It's
a tax.
Yeah.
I think we used the word something like cash value. I mean, we used a different term than credit because it gets confusing when we talked about this before. Because what you actually, you have to show that you have received so many dollars return for your, so this, it's actually equal, it's like getting cash value or some term like that. I agree, to use the word credit is.
And who is going to give these and, you know, kind of purpose on them? Because, you know, we've got Highlands grabbing DDR credits and.
Well, the Farmland Assessment Act.
It's in the Act, so
yeah,
this would be.
Yeah, we can advocate for this.
Well, it does say, it says what we'd be advocating for is an amendment to the Farmland Assessment Act, correct?
Yes.
I have one more question.
We'll change the language there so that there isn't more confusion about
this. In Policy 3A, or anyway, we have the. This, we use the statement fee simple acquisition, and we use that other places in the plan, but if we, or if Green Acres acquires a property that, you know, fee simple, it's theirs now, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's now not preserved as farmland. I mean, how would we keep that as a farm?
Well, if they go through the SADC program, they're preserved as farmland. And if they're auctioned off again, they're still maintained as farmland.
Is that what happens? And they're auctioned off, they can be resold as farmland.
If this time I'm going through the farmland preservation program, yes, they're maintained as working farms, and they're sold off. And there's a covenant that governs into the future used to make them. I think I can't remember the exact words, but it's open.
They're required to maintain the farm in addition. So if you buy it, you sell it, you take the development easement off it, that remains with the state, and then you're allowed to farm it. You have to use best management practices on a preserved farm.
And it's always maintained as available for farming.
Right.
So the property could be purchased, but I'm not talking about a conservation easement. I'm talking about
fee simple purchase. Yeah, the state purchases it and what they do.
But they could still continue to farm it.
Yes, and then they often auction it off. And the next buyer who buys it as a working farm. There's no development rights on it, but they maintain it as a farm, a working farm.
The Chuck Farm in Chester Township, which I was very familiar with, was the first example.
So if Bill owns a farm, but he wants to sell it, and the state buys it, he's simple. He doesn't own it anymore. Right. Now what happens?
The state auctions it off as a preserved
farm. So a different person.
And yes, and that different person buys it with the deed restrictions that come with it, that maintain that it will all, that it will never have those development rights back, and that it will be maintained as farm, agricultural.
Should we state somewhere here that we intend that that's the way it should work? I mean, for people like myself that didn't understand.
Well,
this.
Municipalities also do fee simple. I mean, organizations can do fee simple. There's actually one in Long Valley where they sold the development easements to a third party, and then they were resold. So there's lots of different ways.
But a lot of towns don't do those things. You know, we haven't been buying a lot of farms in Precipity. So.
I won't comment.
So anyway, I just think that it should.
Maybe in the program we'll give an example of it just to make sure that everybody understands the process.
Okay, that's good.
I have one comment on right to farm when we talk about, you know, agricultural retention. Some municipalities have right to farm ordinances that provide greater benefits to farmers. They ought to be recognized in the document as well. And certain times and types of sales and percentages and whatnot at farm stands at a municipal level may be much more liberal. So we're going to recognize that you have municipal ordinances also. Mm-hmm. They can't be more restrictive, but they can be more liberal.
I don't think that we should require, though, all towns to do that where it really is not applicable. I mean,
requiring Hanover's not to farm. Yeah,
if there's no agricultural land,
then it won't be.
If you have a preserved farm, you have to have a right to farm.
Right, that's right. I was saying, but if you don't.
No.
So if you don't, you don't have to.
Good. plan to.
You don't have the right to farm, you can't have a preserve farm. You know, the other way.
Well, Jack, you don't have a right to farm ordinance, you can't have a preserve farm.
Right. It's just that the way you say we do it, everybody's got to have that.
Other comments on agricultural resources? Okay. Future land use.
What have we put together here, map adjustments and future land use, because they are related. If you'll allow me, I'll talk about map adjustments first, because then we refer to them in future land use, so it's easier to deal with it first. Map adjustments changes from the 2007 November final draft and now. First of all, is the clear distinction between the application of the regional master plan updates and map adjustments. We've pulled these apart because it's made it easier for everybody to understand them. So right now we're only dealing with the adjustments. We dealt with the updates at an earlier council meeting. We've added here the language that map adjustments can only be used after waivers, exemptions, updates, and other approaches have already been examined. So you go through a process where you look at those opportunities first, and you prove that before you petition for a map adjustment. Priority would be given to conforming municipalities and encouragement for municipal coordination when appropriate, because sometimes it makes these sort of things easier when they're on the border between towns. A refined criteria for different zones, which I'll show you in the next slide, establishes standards and establishes requirements for digital submissions. Now this is two columns here, map adjustments. The adjustments to protection zone, conservation zone, or environmentally constrained subzones. There has to be a proof of no net loss of Highlands resources and resource values within a municipality, and as appropriate within a HUC 14 sub-watershed. This was in the 2007 draft as well. We've added here no net increase in land use intensity. That the adjustment complies with the intent of the Highlands Act and the Regional Master Plan. We've added criteria for adjustments resulting in extension of the existing community zone. Now this language in the other column is addressing proposed changes to an existing community zone to a different land use capability map zone or subzone. You have to show that it's not currently developed at a density and scale which is inconsistent with the zone change. Not currently served by public wastewater infrastructure, because that wouldn't be suitable for one of those other zones. That includes ecological or agricultural attributes that are associated with the requested zones. And finally, that it doesn't include a designated redevelopment site or a TDR receiving zone. That's just to make sure that it's very clear that you don't go from an existing community zone to the other zones if some of those conditions apply. For example, if it's already a designated TDR receiving zone, it certainly wouldn't be appropriate to move it to the protection zone. That's all on map adjustments. You want me to move through the future land use?
I'm just curious, should we differentiate between map adjustments and map updates, which are going on now as we gather better data from municipalities and counties?
We've absolutely sought to do that. One of the things we're doing with that is to separate these programs, and that's why we're only doing adjustments with you today. We did updates at a previous meeting. Updates are simply factual information that we get. So updated layer of open space, preserved lands, updated.
Right, just maybe though in the update thing we say these are not adjustments, see blah, blah, blah. And maybe here we say this does not include updates, see blah, blah, blah.
We could do that, meaning yes.
Well, I think this is actually in the map adjustments at the start of the fourth paragraph. Mm-hmm. It says fact-based updates are addressed in the update program.
Thank you.
Very good job. So, why don't you go through the other one?
Okay. Future land GPOs, the policies and objectives were consolidated. I wanted to talk a bit about the local build-out analysis. It is required through plan conformance the Highlands build-out model will be provided, because we're doing the build-out at a regional level, and so it can be applied then using local information, so it makes it somewhat easier to get to the next step, which is that local build-out. And what we want to make sure is that that build-out model that's provided to the municipalities will be sufficient to address build-out requirements of other state agencies. So you have COA, you've got Department of Environmental Protection, Department of Transportation, and the Office of Smart Growth all look at build-out models. We want to make sure that the information is sufficient for all of them. And the regional build-out analysis that we are doing is required for plan endorsement, which is a process that we're required to go through after adoption of the plan. And then for the land use capability map zone policies, incorporating the lake community subzone concepts and amplifying on environmentally constrained subzones and the need for priority preservation focus in those areas. That's everything on future land GPOs.
Will it be sufficient to address build-out requirements of other state agencies? You're specifically referring to COA?
All the other state agencies, because what we see is different state agencies are requiring different build-out. We want to make sure that we have one that satisfies them all.
So do you mean by that we have to, if you don't mean, I don't think that we're saying there has to be enough land available. You're saying there has to be enough clarity?
The model itself responds to all the necessary elements of a build-out model for the other agencies. So if they want to look at what's the developed land, the zoning, all those issues, the model will address all those issues.
The answer is yes.
So you're talking about in terms of the tool, that we want to have a tool that they can use?
A tool that can be used, yes. In other words, when we do our build-out model, the information we supply is sufficient for all other agencies. Not the answers, but the method to get there, so that we deal with developable lands and the results we get. Each of the agencies has appropriate information.
I'm looking for their buy-off, though.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think that bullet is confusing.
Okay.
Or it raises a flag that we don't mean to be raising. I mean, we want it to be a tool that's useful for municipal and county governments, too.
Yes.
We want the build-out analysis to be as useful as possible for all levels of government.
That's it in a nutshell, John. Okay.
Yes. That'd be a better way to say it.
It's whatever way Chair said. We've got to change the bullet. We won't put this on the website so it matches what you say.
You should call them this user.
Right, right. Well, it was the other way around, but I think raising the concern.
I have one question.
Yes, go ahead.
On policy 6B5, under this section,
this is under
future land use, 6B5 require conforming municipalities to include site development programs. This is in the conservation zone, right? Or is this in all zones?
Okay.
All zones?
Yes.
Then I would suggest it should say such as clustering and lot size averaging, because
okay.
There may be some, you know, they might not want to do that.
Right.
So.
Such as instead of including.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Tracy, thank you.
Okay. Other comments? Okay.
This is the section that we spoke of before, the landowner equity, and this was in an effort, as we said, to put. As we went through all of these sections, we had the same questions coming up about waivers and exemptions. So for consistency and to avoid repetition, this section will include the Act's exemptions and waivers as applicable throughout the Regional Master Plan. And three new goals were added. Goal 7F says to ensure that Highlands Act exemptions are properly issued and monitored. Goal 7G, to ensure that Highlands Act permits and waivers are properly issued, tracked, and monitored. And Goal 7H, mitigation to the maximum extent possible of the impacts of exempt development on the ecosystem integrity of the Highlands region through the use of innovative land use programs. And this is so that we've talked about this at prior meetings, where, for example, you have exemptions. You might offer bonus credits through the TDR program to a landowner who willingly chooses not to to use that exemption. Also, if a landowner doesn't want to, chooses not to use their exemption and instead go into a land preservation program, we will do that to the maximum extent possible. Tom, do you want to talk a little bit more about the exemptions of the applied preservation planning area?
Well, I think just to follow up on what we said previously before is that right now the primary focus of exemptions is in the preservation area because that's where the DEP rules apply. But the Act provides that exemptions can be exercised in the planning area as well. But we wanted to bring out to your attention that there are two exemptions that are not applicable in the planning area, but we need to develop guidance before implementation of these exemptions as towns come into conformance to make it clear to everyone that the resource protection standards of the master plan is subject to an exemption, and those exemptions can be exercised, and that the Towns Council would be processing these exemptions in the planning area. Just as DEP is doing that now in the preservation area.
Right, looking forward to that. The land and recre section starts with the word additionally.
There's more text in here from. This is a supplement to the TDR, so we just took out the TDR language.
Okay.
The TDR language would be above that.
Okay.
That we did last week, you mean?
Yes. Exactly. And so this is just a supplemental to that, so we'll add this in.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you see it starts at 7F.
Right.
Everything up to 7F is TDR.
Okay.
Just trying to say something.
Okay. So the heading for part 7 here is landowner equity, or is it?
Yes. The heading was landowner fairness, and so we changed landowner equity.
Comments, questions?
I would just say when we discussed these exemptions earlier today, we said maybe we should have something that identifies which apply to the planning area.
And if you look at, it's objective 7F1E, talks about exemptions number 3 and 17 that are
only applicable in
the preservation area. And then 7F1F talks about exemptions 9 and 11 because there's a subtle difference there as well, because those exemptions from the Act state that they must be consistent with the goals and purposes of the Act.
I understand it, but it might be just nice to have just a little mark on each of them saying if it's
We can do that. Just
planning,
say not applicable.
Or
okay.
I would like to do that.
Done.
Because I always thought they were just
other comments on this section? Okay.
And finally, what we gave you a sample of the guidance that we propose to give for municipal plan conformance with the Highlands Regional Master Plan. It's an example of project review and planning guidance. It's based on the goals, policies, and objectives discussed at the May 1st, 2008 meeting. The example we gave you was for steep slopes, and it provides detailed guidance interpreting the GPOs with regard to environmental resource inventory, the master plan and conservation element, development review checklist, development review ordinance, and enforcement. So we would follow this same process for each of the resources that would require ordinances and be included in this manner, following it straight through with the ERI, master plan, etc., and provide references where available. Developing similar guidance for each of the issues, and it can be used by conforming towns and other towns in and outside of the region. Compiling relevant guidance for each of the each performance component, as we just talked about, the ERI, Master Plan Checklist and Ordinance, and creating easy-to-use models for plan conformance that could be adopted as-is or modified to fit into existing municipal documents. And if you look at the last page of that document, you'll see that there is an example of a model sample ordinance given as well. So the The reason we want to give this to this evening is this would not be part of the regional master plan. The standards would be in the goals, policies, and objectives, but this would be done for each, and will be done by plan, for each of the issues to give in a sort of a plan, a guidance document to municipalities.
What's your sense of timing of when that would be?
We're working on all those issues right now, so July 17th.
So this would be available when we adopt the plan?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. This is a huge piece of work.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I mean, this example is terrific, I think. It'd be helpful. Other comments?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions from council members before we turn to public comment?
John? Derek Peterson.
Hi, Eric.
I'm gonna cut off at this point since we got done the meeting itself.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Turn to public comments. And if anyone else has to go, I'm going to state that our next. Unfortunately, this is our last meeting in May, but we are meeting again in June. And June 5th at 10 o'clock is our next meeting. Comments? Public comments? None? Okay. Yes.
Wonderful. Betty Schultheis, I'm a councilwoman in Alamuchi. And actually, this is relative to something someone said at the last meeting.
Excuse me.
And that is, I think a couple of people cautioned you that you had to be very careful of COA requirements, and they have a sneaky way of overriding whatever's been decided by anyone else. And I would just say one of my concerns is that in the TDR process, I really don't see that as being a lot different than the provision of RCAs under COA, in that an RCA is a regional contribution agreement whereby a municipality can give their COA requirements to another municipality. And that was part of the COA agreement early on. And now recently, Mr. Doria has said they don't want to do that anymore because it's discriminatory. And I would just caution you that TDRs might be put into that same category if you were giving them from one municipality to another. And that no one seems to be looking at the reality of how COA is working. In other words, specifically, I could give you an example in Alamuchi. We have rental units, and we have 22 of them. And for two, we still have a vacant unit. I mean, there's talk about we need 100,000 more affordable housing units in the state, and yet we have a unit that's never yet been rented. This is the second year. So I don't think there's a very good grip on what the requirements are for the state, and so I just would caution you that they like to go big.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, sorry.
We're back to landowner equity because, quite frankly, I don't care about toads and salamanders. I really don't, particularly when they are stripping equity away from me. Nor do I care about their defenders. I heard something earlier about 80 or 90% of the water is used for ecological uses. This is how we have a water deficit, because somebody has declared 80 or 90% of the water not available for human use. It's to be used for, quote, ecological use, whatever that means. I'd like a clarification of that. And also what we're developing here is the Napoleonic Code, where we, as applicants to do anything, have to prove that we are doing no harm. This is the Napoleonic Code, and it's not even Louisiana. Many years ago, when Adam Zellner was sitting over there, and I complained about the loss of landowner equity to him, he said, oh, we haven't taken it all. We've taken all but that much. Charlie Seaman said essentially the same thing. We've taken all but that much. Judges in this state have said the same thing. You've taken all but that much. Leave them a little something and it's okay. Now I'm going to talk about science. This is where people look at things and write down the results. This concerns chimpanzees, our closest relative. You take two chimps, you put them in a cage, you watch what they do, you set up a situation where if they act cooperatively, they get a treat, even though they're separated from each other in separate cages. Then the scientists changed the ratio of who got rewarded for what for their cooperative effort. They found that the chimps, after the disproportionate share of the rewards became to a certain point, which I won't tell you. I want you to find out for yourself. One chimp would not cooperate. The short-change chimps refused to cooperate, and no chimp got anything. You're approaching that point. And what this shows me is that Adam Zollner, Charlie Siemens, the judges who say you can take all but that much, have not yet achieved, they have not evolved to the level of ethical standards that apes have. Don't fall into the same trap.
Good afternoon, Elliot Rubin, New Jersey Highlands Coalition, and I've just been writing some notes feverishly on some changes in or some additions to the MAP adjustments program, so I'm going to try to be as clear as possible. MAP adjustments requested or petitioned by a municipality for planning purposes, for non-regional planning purposes, based not on scientific data that the council's LUC series of maps is so proudly based is not a great idea. That, in addition, that non-conforming municipalities will be allowed to petition for map adjustments is troubling. You should not provide non-conforming municipalities equal standing with those in the planning area who do conform. Already, any municipality can point to the Highlands data as the most current and use it as a valid legal criteria for their own, for non-regional planning. To allow them to also petition for map adjustments for their planning purposes does not sell conformance. That any municipality, conforming or not, using petitioning for a map adjustment for non-regional planning purposes, not science-based, even if you require no net loss within the municipality or Hub 14 sub watershed, sounds like horse trading. Thanks.
Hello, Helen Heinrich, New Jersey Farm Bureau. First of all, I have a couple of things to give to you. I found a report on a research project that documents what farmers and communities get from farmers markets and agritourism. And it certainly, it was done by the Food Policy Institute at Rutgers and the Food Innovation Center and some other people. And I'm certainly going to try to get a copy, but I think this might be something you want to put in your toolkit for development of the policies for agriculture. The second thing is we've said from the very beginning that we thought the definition of sustainable agriculture should be in the glossary, because there's some people that believe that sustainable is only organic, and the Farm Bill definition is much broader than that. And we think that would clarify, be another clarification that might be helpful. In terms of the changes in the ag resources, we want to take a look at that. It's kind of hard to tell in your format what's changed without going back and forth between the various versions of the plan. I think the farm community is totally opposed to the concept of changing farmland assessment to include some kind of benefits for people doing woodland management, forest stewardship, invasive species, and so forth. There is an awful lot of public concern, if not opposition, to farmland assessment anyway. And the farm community feels if you broaden this so that people who don't have to produce even, you know, timber products can qualify for this so it's considered an unfair tax benefit, could weaken the whole program entirely. And there should be some other way of doing that, because farmers would certainly agree that what needs to be done to manage the forests costs a lot of money and does not necessarily produce a monetary return in products. But, you know, please don't propose changing the Farmland Assessment Act. Let's figure out some other way to do it. And then it seemed to me I heard that you had met with Monique Purcell and Susan Kraft on some AMPs. And are you proposing specific AMPs to the Highlands? Or, you know, it sounds like maybe there's going to be a whole set of different ag management practices for the Highlands to support the resources, separate from the ones that support agriculture around the state. So I guess I appreciate some clarification about that. It's very difficult to get AMPs done anyway, so if we have two sets, it's certainly going to be confusing. Thank you. Oh, one more thing. it seems like in this discussion about standards-based versus flexibility, you get the feeling that some council members really want to make it easier for the towns by having absolute rigid monetary standards instead of allowing the site-specific process to proceed. And isn't it possible that there would be more litigation if you set standards that could easily be proven not to apply to a particular site? I mean, that's why you have the variance process municipal land use planning rather than rigid 300-foot buffers where someone could prove that that's really, you know, not the best thing for the water quality in that situation.
Thank you. Sure.
Frank Minchin with the Department of Agriculture. I'm afraid I can't answer that question since I was not part of the meeting with Ms. Purcell and Susan Kraft. So I really can't shed any light on that particular matter. I would like to just confine my comments tonight to talk about the functional value discussion we had earlier today. Having dealt with functional value under the stormwater rules, I can tell you it's a very cumbersome, difficult standard to hold. In most cases, most of the proposed activities fail to meet that for one or many reasons. And I know the discussion today really centered around people who wanted to do actual significant disturbance within the buffer. But from the stormwater rules aspect, we also have problems with just encroachment into the buffer through just the simple stormwater outfall. we could not demonstrate meeting thermal impact because the stormwater outfall would exceed the temperature modifications from this from detention basin. This is problematic primarily because we have a conflict with the Soil Erosion and Sediment Control Act rules, and particularly the standard for offsite stability, where we are looking to try to find a stable outlet for that pipe, which may in fact encroach within that 300-foot buffer. So we have a lot of issues. So I just want to make the council aware that there are some complications, not limited to just someone building a shopping center within a buffer. So to please keep that in mind. With that, thank the council. And Ms. Purcell couldn't be here tonight. She had a conflict, so I'm here. So, okay.
Thank you. Comments?
Deborah Post, Chester Township. There's been a lot of discussion today on how much wiggle room should be in some of the standards. We've heard about variable source alternative techniques. We've heard about map adjustments. We've heard about a plan with a buffer that better protects the stream. This is the issue. We are basically creating a fertile cat habitat for corruption and bribes here. Will your property support a science-based plan becomes code for how much have you contributed to your needy influencer recently? We see this again on the achievement versus the implementation of a plan. So you can agree to do a major mitigation project, spend a huge amount of money doing it, and then be told that you haven't achieved your results. This is not kind of a lobbyist versus the landowner issue here. This is the rich versus the poor. And what you're really creating is a public park for the rich, as I've said over and over again. It's going to be a public park for the super rich who are willing to pay to play. I also would like to note that although there's been much talk about farmland preservation here today, the farmland preservation people don't think they're in the business of providing just compensation per the Highlands Act, and they don't want to even hear about it. So this council member, this council should know that, how you address it. I'd now like to discuss some TDRs. I attended the TDR committee meeting last week, and there's some very, very important issues here. First of all, the TDR handout that we just picked up out there does disclose that you're talking about a $16,000 initial offering price for an HDC, the Highland Development Credit. What it doesn't disclose in that hand-up is what we learned in the last committee meeting, which is it's estimated that 20 to 40,000 credits will be allocated and issued. If you take an average of that 20, 40, take 30, and multiply it by the $16,000, you come up with $480 million, or roughly $500 million. Now think about that, everyone. $500 million to fully just compensate everything in this Highlands Act? The Hohenstein Report said $15 billion. Most estimates prior to the Hohenstein Report were in the $6 to $10 billion. And now your TDR committee has issued something saying that only $500 million of TDR credits are going to be issued. All right, now let's look at this. Why does this really say this? First of all, the simple answer is that to go with the junk science, we now have junk data. But the HDCs are way too low. If there's a maximum 40,000 HDCs, and Lisa Jackson told us that there was 215,000 lost build rights, how do you get only 40,000 TDRs for 215,000 lost build rights? Numbers don't really feel very good here. How did they come up with the number of HDCs? Well, they used a lot of tax junk data. They looked at lots from the satellite. Can you really tell the number of lots from the satellite? Probably not. Number 2 point is they use tax data. Tax data is not market value. Everybody knows that. The courts of New Jersey, our federal courts, never ever use tax assessment data to determine fair market value. It's just not done. But the committee to this council is using tax assessed data to determine the lost value of our properties, and it's just plain wrong. We all know that tax data has to do with the last reval date, and please don't talk to me about equalization rates. That's not their purpose. It might help in certain instances, but this is not the place you play equalization rate games. So the whole data underpinnings, even though the conceptual framework may actually be okay, they haven't shared the arithmetic with us, so we're not exactly sure. But the data they're dumping into the model is just the wrong data. Now let's go to the initial offering price of $16,000. When we said to them 16,000 times the 30,000 HDCs, that's hardly $500 million, doesn't feel good, doesn't sound right. The response we got was, well, Ms. Post, you know very well that you never set an initial price at fair market value. You always set your initial price below market value. This is somewhat true. But then it came out that the initial market, your initial $16,000 price is being set at 75% below fair market value. Does everyone on this committee know that you're anticipating 75% below fair market value for your initial price? And what is this saying? This is basically saying that you're going to let the desperate people come in first and take them out cheap. And we all know that the desperate people here are the elderly who were previously land rich and cash poor and are now cash poor and land poor, who need retirement money, who need their medical expenses paid, who need to pay for their kids' education, and you're going to force them into this market first at 75% below their fair market value. Ethical integrity, guys, you know, come on. As to the question about it always being set a little bit below market, that is true, but it's not 75%. It's a couple percent to give the market some encouragement. If a banker were to set an offering price at 75% below market without disclosing that to the client, it's a litigation setup. Tender offers usually have opinion letters attached disclosing fair market value. So if I leave one substantive comment here today, you've got to disclose what the real fair market value is, what the value of the land as of 2004, what the value of the taking was. You need to disclose the value of the taking in big, bold, red numbers on the front page of the prospectus. If you then want to set the initial price at 99% below, that's fine, because everybody won't know and won't come to your market and it will fail. But there needs to be full disclosure here, and you really need to think about the ethical implications of setting these numbers so low and pretending that unsophisticated people are going to walk in first and get burned. Can't use the tax data. Oh, one other point. The reason they use the tax data, they don't have any other data. And why don't they have any other data? The set of land sales between 2003 and 2005 is de facto empty. So as soon as there was Highlands Act information leak, was that the end of 2003? Was that early 2004? The market dried up. So you can't go look at comps around the time this act was passed and expect to find anything. There was no market. It had already been killed. So maybe you've got to go back to 2002, 2001. But you need to look at real comps here and do real appraisal methodology, which never includes tax data. Thank you.
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition.
you will not be surprised to hear that we are extremely disappointed that you have not dropped the mitigation program in deficit subwatersheds. What you're proposing is an extremely complicated program, hard to explain, hard to administer, will be very consumptive of staff time that you don't have available, and will be challenged in court over and over. We think it is the wrong thing to do to not give up at this time on a mitigation program in deficit subwatersheds. The flip side is, thank you for the special environmental zones. We are amongst those who have been saying, where are they? Where are they? It's the access you have to have that, and it hasn't been here. So thank you for that. Map adjustments. Map adjustments, as with everything, we need, because we don't get to see anything until we arrive, we need more time to review that, as we do for everything else that you have out and have considered today, particularly the Highlands Open Waters and riparian areas. However, some initial thoughts also, in addition to what Elliot was saying, which is a really important point, we do think that the hierarchy of avoidance, minimization, and mitigation, including included in critical habitat GPOs and open water GPOs, the buffer GPOs, should be reflected in these map adjustment protocols. And I don't know if it was just accidental that it was not. The same functional value analyses should also be required there as part of the map adjustment process. And then the last comment today is on build-out. I think it makes a lot of sense that towns are only going to have to do one build-out analysis, that this build-out analysis will meet the requirements of all levels of government. And you're helping towns when you help them with this and provide them with a lot of data. Towns that opt in and go through this process are being given a great benefit by going through the conformance process and doing this. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Yes,
sir. Andy Drysdale, Chester Township, good evening. Environmental extremism, that's what has created the Highlands Act. The DEP is full of environmental extremists. And you can see when you drive up to the gas pump today what environmental extremists have done to us and are doing to us and what's happening to this country. So we need to think about that. Thank you.
Hello, Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. I have a few comments on a few of these different papers here. Okay. On the land preservation and stewardship paper, I think it's good that the council is defining a special environmental zone. I question the size of it. Somehow it seems pretty small compared to the acreage in the preservation area, which all seem to be quite important, like 400-some-thousand acres down to 19,000. It just seems like the criteria must be incredibly strict. Let's see. On policy... 1I3, which has to do with municipalities and counties including an open space preservation and land stewardship program in their master plans and development regulations. The policy of requiring that is great, but policy 1I3 requires that conforming municipalities and counties require conservation and land stewardship easements. And they're enforceable by a bunch of agencies, Highlands Council, SADC, CADD, or Green Acres. Land trusts are not even mentioned in this. I question why that is so. In my municipality, the organization I work for, New Jersey Conservation Foundation, has a number of easements that we enforce. My municipality has about 350 easements. Do they monitor them? No, never, not done. It's only if someone happens to notice something egregious going on that something gets called to the attention of the township officials. NJCF, in accordance with the new Land Trust Council standards, monitors every single easement it has once a year to make sure that the easement is being complied with. I strongly urge that the land trusts in the Highlands or any that hold land easements in the region be added to this list of agencies that enforce the easements, because you're going to get a much better job in general done by having the nonprofits do it than having some of the agencies do it. That, I mean, the agencies just don't have the staff to do this. I wish they did, but it's really and very unfortunate oversight that land trusts are not mentioned in here. In general, we sort of found that in the land preservation section that the contribution of a land trust had not really been recognized. They have not been considered a partner in land acquisition either, the way that we think they could be and be of help to preserving the Highlands. In the same document, Goal IJ, which talks about the preservation of forests in private ownership through a forest preservation easement program, in policy IJ1, we and the rest of the environmental community strongly urge that the forest preservation easement program for the Highlands be administered by the Green Acres program and by DEP and not by the State Agricultural Development Committee. The kinds of values that the Highlands plan is supposed to protect include ecological values, wildlife habitat values. They are values that are within the purview of the expertise of the DEP as opposed to the expertise of the Agricultural Development Committee. And we strongly urge that this program be administered by the Green Acres program. In the next objective IJ1A, to achieve the preservation of working forests of the Forest Preservation Easement Program, again, it's the same thing that the DEP has the expertise, and it should include habitat enhancement, threatened endangered species protection, management of invasive species, management of water resources, quality and quantity, and those are not the primary focus of the quote working forest component of the Agricultural Department. So we strongly urge that this be administered by the DEP, as we have said many times in the past. In the agricultural resources policy paper, we will be sending in some written. What is that?
I don't know. It could
somebody
be
calling in?
I don't know.
It's not somebody calling in trying to finish the meeting.
No.
Okay.
But a campaign call.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to shut off all of my phone extensions, and I got caught near one. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So it is Debbie. Okay. We will be sending in comments on this, but I'd just like to note a few points here in policy.
Can you sort of wrap up your comments?
Yeah, okay. Well, our comments have to do with that there should be, in some of these cases, like 3B4, the farm where you have advocating credit for the control of invasive species, whitetail deer reduction programs, and the water value of well-managed lands. That should only be if there is an impervious cover limit in place on the land. And we have concerns about the forest management plans, that they should be stewardship plans instead, which apply to the values that I was speaking of previously. And we have concerns about the clusters and how they would be designated. We strongly urge that you take into account Ms. Carluccio's comments on the water issues, which we support. And lastly, I have just some comments on the minutes, what I was supposed to have said, which is not quite accurate, and I would like to see in a written statement of finding that.
I'll correct that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How many other people like to speak? Sure. Okay.
Marion Harris, Morris County Trust for Historic Preservation. First, I'd like to say what an enormous pleasure it was to hear Bill raise the question of missing references to historic resources. It was, however, a short-lived pleasure. I don't even remember which section you raised it in connection with, because you could have raised it in connection with any of these things. But what struck me was the lack of response from anybody else on the council. Nobody seems to think that these mentions are missing. I do understand that you have started putting in some cross-references between sections, which is exactly what we've been asking from the beginning. Will you please mention historic resources in places where they would be appropriately brought up? I can give you a couple of examples of that. One of them is in the riparian section. Of course, anytime you're talking about riparian areas, there's a possibility that you're going to need some archaeology. So if you are describing the mapping or applications that involve riparian areas, it would be a very good idea to make a cross-reference there to the possibility that archaeological resources would be found there. You're not going to find structures, obviously, on the banks of streams so much anymore, but the archaeology is a real question to raise. In the land stewardship section, apparently it didn't occur to the writers that land and historic sites are complementary, and that when you are talking about stewardship for land, you should also be talking about stewardship for historic resources. And I wish that we could see some mention of this specifically at times when it would be appropriate. For instance, and this is just one, and it would take some other adjustments of the languages in the place, in the land stewardship policy 1H4, where it's talking about sources of funding for preservation and stewardship of open space lands, you could easily say, and for sites which should be preserved as historic resources. That's all we're asking for, just that kind of quick mention as a cross-reference. But speaking of funding, I am really kind of puzzled about this coordinate with SHPO about the funding sources for historic sites. There is a federal tax credit for income-producing property. This was in the agriculture thing, I think. And you decided to be quite specific about the fact that there are historic agricultural buildings, and that because they are income-producing properties, I guess this is what you know. I don't know how specifically you know it, but that's the only kind of funding source that there is for income-producing properties. So you can say, yes, we're going to talk to SHPO about those. But there are a lot of other income-producing properties that are historic and that you could coordinate with SHPO on. So if you want to mention it when they're agricultural buildings, you can mention it also when they're other kinds of buildings. That's just one sort of example. The land stewardship section is full of places where you could toss in a reference, and it would be nice to see some of those show up sometime. Thank you.
Mark Sakuchansky, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I just want to take a minute and commend the council members today for asking questions about the issues that were being raised. Any questions that you guys have, no matter how simple they seem, are 10 times as complicated as an issue for the public to get their hands around. So please keep asking questions, and if you don't understand an issue, raise that issue, because we're seeing the documents for the first time when we walk in the door. We don't have any advance notice to take a look at these issues and see what's being proposed. So please keep asking questions and encourage public discourse on these issues. And I want to thank the council staff for a lot of clarifying changes to the language. We've seen a lot of improvements today and in the past in a lot of the documents that have been coming out. So we encourage cross-referencing and making use of language that's easily accessible and readable by members of the public and people that are going to be reviewing this document and using this document. So thank you again, and I look forward to seeing more positive changes in the future.
Thank you. Any other comments? Nice note to end on. Any comments from council members on the present or on the phone? Our next meeting, as I said, is June 5th at 10 o'clock. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Move.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you all.
You can imagine. Whoa.